I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, editorial writer and columnist Robert George, and freelance writer Brian Bennett. Welcome, everybody. I may jump in here or there, but for now, take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, what's up? Welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
Hey, good.
Hello
good.
There.
Hey, Chill Rob G and Busy B back again for the first time, bro. Welcome back to the shop.
Thank you.
Well, you know what? Check this out, man. Sensitive intel about our methods of interrogation were unclassified recently. And you know what? They're out there in the ether now. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, he backed the release because he viewed the release of them as inevitable. And Obama is talking about the possibility of prosecuting the lawyers involved that signed off on these Bush-era memos. He says, I think there were a host of very complicated issues here. Yeah. No doubt, dude. this cat is more flip-flopping than John Kerry at the House of Pancakes.
Rob G here.
Go ahead, Rob.
I'm all for prosecuting lawyers. In fact, I think all lawyers should be prosecuted.
Hey.
But when he was president-elect, it was very clear that the president didn't want to go down this road. He said, we'll change the policies that we think were done incorrectly, but let's move forward on this. And then this week, Mr. Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, goes on and basically says the same thing, but then suddenly all of the people on the left who kind of want blood out of the Bush administration people say, no, we've got to see this. We've got to, pillory them up on the stocks and things like that. And so the president starts to back away from it. And I think it's a really bad idea. First of all, it's a bad idea, I think, to have released these memos in the first place. And secondly, it does not look good for the commander in chief to look indecisive this way.
But wasn't he saying the people who shouldn't be prosecuted are the people who acted in good faith and carried out the policy?
This is Arsalan. As the one lawyer in the barbershop right now, to remind everyone, the Convention Against Torture was signed by Ronald Reagan in 1988, ratified by the Senate in 1994, and it states quite clearly, quote, that an order from a superior officer or a public authority may not be invoked as a justification for torture. So if foot soldiers at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq can be prosecuted for torture, then why not John Yoo, J. Bybee, and Dick, don't call me Darth Vader Cheney.
But there are two questions. No, hold on. So I want to wrap. There are two questions, Arsalan. One is the legal question. One is the political question.
Right.
And the legal question is, can people be prosecuted?
Yes.
And the second question is, did the president change his mind or appear to change his mind about that fact?
He did.
The record is pretty clear that his initial instinct was that people should not be if they acted in good faith within the direction that they were given.
Right.
Right. And the third question is the people who offered that legal direction, who
right.
created that legal framework. Mm-hmm. So there are really
but,
three.
Am I going to get in trouble for pointing out that just following orders was also a Nuremberg defense? Go ahead, Rob.
A lawyer who is giving an analysis of a certain situation and in a sense giving his advice based on what he's reading, why is that not also considered acting in good faith based on the way the president described it?
Because, Robert, when Jay Bybee in his memo said that waterboarding is essentially not the legal equivalent of torture, he is going beyond the scope of what torture has become defined under international and American
analysis. Robert, hold on a minute. Is the argument then that he was knowingly misinterpreting the law or that he's simply mistaken?
A little bit of both. I mean, now, Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice both in one way or another had authorized, these quote-unquote excessive interrogation methods. And so, the buck has to stop somewhere. If we're going to prosecute the soldiers at Abu Ghraib for torturing, then we have to prosecute the people who are giving those orders under command responsibility in international law.
Brian
has
something to say.
I mean, I think, especially with Abu Ghraib, I think it's a completely different situation. That's a breakdown of order and discipline. And I think that has to be separate from this discussion. I think with the lawyers operating the Justice Department, I mean, they were clearly trying to get as close as they could to authorizing the most aggressive tactics they could. And if they gave analysis that wasn't sound, then I think that was a lapse in their legal judgment. And there are ways through Office of Personnel inside the Justice Department and investigating them as lawyers that that you can take care of that.
And look, but Robert here, if a lawyer is giving an opinion either to his client, which is the United States here, and he says in his opinion that this is not the legal equivalent, why should we consider that prosecutable?
This is our salon. Robert, you know, it's like if some Justice Department official wrote a memo authorizing assassination or the internment of minorities in America. I mean, you know, these are actionable legal, you know, memos. He is writing on behalf of the Justice Department of the United States of America. And let's also not forget that Jay Bybee, after he left the Justice Department, is now a federal judge.
But what about Robert's point? Do you get prosecuted for being wrong?
Well, a lot of people are prosecuted for being wrong, and especially when they're acting under the color of law.
That's an interesting situation. I mean, often if a police officer, for example, violates somebody's, you know, Miranda rights or things like that, you have a lot of options open to you in terms of, other than just, say, prosecuting somebody for being incorrect.
But would you be opposed to a truth commission, bipartisan truth commission, being set up to release all these memos to actually find out what actually happened?
I would not necessarily be opposed to that, because I think one of the things that Dick Cheney has pointed out, and as have other members from the Bush administration, saying some of these memos that have yet to be released, according to Vice President Cheney, actually disprove that. They actually prove that these methods helped prevent other attacks or B, helped track down some of the people who were helping plan 9/11.
And of course, his testimony is unimpeachable.
Yeah, exactly. And
well, some of that's already been reported by reporters. I mean, the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah right. led to the arrest of Ramzi bin al-Shib. I was in Karachi as a reporter at the time during that arrest, and they found his safe house and grabbed a computer, and the information from that led to the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
And the people who offered the information who led to the arrest of the people who committed the Nairobi embassy bombings, the confessions were obtained with no inappropriate methods
right.
at all
by
the FBI.
And reports show that most of the actionable intelligence, like the Abu Zubaydah bin al-Shib connection, were done before the waterboarding 266 times even occurred. And I think
so. Basically, is the argument the ends justify the means?
That's essentially what they're saying.
I mean, Robert, is that your argument?
Sounds like it.
I think in certain cases, perhaps it does.
Does that apply to poor people too?
Are you talking about, like, you know, Les Miserables,
yeah.
if somebody steals a loaf of bread to feed their family?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe sometimes, I mean, in certain cases that does. The point here we're talking about, and this is the real nub of the whole question of torture. If you feel that there is about to be another attack and you feel that using extraneous methods, even if they may be illegal, may prevent that, are there absolutely no circumstances where you would not do that?
Can I ask one more, Jimmy, one more question before we move on?
Yes,
Jimmy,
ma'am.
Does the conversation we're having here now suggest that this is one of those looping conversations that, to which there would be no end, and in a way it's not really productive? Or does the conversation suggest that it really is something that we need to thoroughly debate as a society?
We should absolutely be debating this. We should not be signing off on torture. I mean, this isn't something where you go from case to case, you know, for real. You know, you got Chill Rob G talking about, well, I guess it depends. Guess what? We got soldiers overseas. We don't want their captors like, oh, well, this is how they get down. This is how we have to get down. We don't want to do that.
Brian, get one more
yeah,
word.
Yeah, this is Brian here. I think that the ticking bomb scenario does bring up an interesting point about the prosecutions. I mean, if there is an individual, an interrogator who feels like he's in the room with this guy and this guy knows when the plane's taken off to fly into the White House, and he takes it upon himself to go that extra distance and breaks the law, then you know, take him before a judge and a jury and let them decide if the circumstances warranted it. And that's another reason I think it's important that this information's come out and that we have these debates.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop with Brian Bennett, Jimmy Israel, Robert George, and Arsalan Iftikhar. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. And shiny happy news this week. Earth Day was this week. And I wrote on theroot.com, you know, I just wasn't sure, what does Earth Day mean for poor people? I mean, you know, when money is a major issue, you know, of course, there are common sense things like around the house, like turning off the Xbox or making sure the hot comb is unplugged. But, you know, when it's about planting trees and all that kind of stuff, you have other priorities. What could Earth Day possibly mean for poor people?
Hey, it's Brian here.
Go ahead, man.
I think it's really important. I think actually because the poor neighborhoods tend to be the most vulnerable to problems in the environment, to the runoff from factories. Certainly to the high levels of PCBs in soil and water that can lead to low sperm count in Seattle called South Park that had pollution in its water and was seeing the effects. They stood up and they got the city to clean it up in 2008.
I just don't know the poor people are concerned about the sperm count, Busy Bee. I'm just going to put that out there, man. You know what I mean? I think it's about daily survival. I mean, you know,
I don't think I'm going to touch that one.
Robert's going green. Robert, I know you're going green. I know you're growing cherry tomatoes on your terrace.
I'm going green. I'm going cherry tomatoes. And I think that the whole green thing is almost a kind of a luxury of the middle class, if you kind of think about it.
Because some of the more poor people,
they're not the ones that can afford, say, a Prius, you know, be a little bit more green and has less carbon emissions. If you're poor, you're going to be driving an older car that might not be
quite as something
that may not be quite as green or nice to the environment. So,
but that's where government policy plays a role, doesn't it, Robert? I understand as a conservative, you're a fan of tax credits. I mean, isn't tax credits something that government policy could do to allow people to acquire some of these green technologies?
Well, I don't know whether tax credits is going to help buy a brand new Prius or something like that. But
why not? It does. Well, I mean, there are tax credits for purchases of hybrids. There can be tax credits for the purchases of more energy efficient appliances.
Well, the fact that you may get tax credits for the air conditioner when the cash that you have in your hand is either going for rent or for food or things like that isn't going to help you at all.
Okay, well, I'll
much.
Remember that when we next talk about health care reform. That's awesome.
I knew that was coming.
Michelle spun me into her web.
Mm-hmm. It's all right. Well, you know what? Speaking of it getting hot, it's getting hot out in California. Where Miss California got into a little bit of a debate with celebrity blogger Perez Hilton on the sticky issue of same-sex marriage in the Miss USA pageant. And I believe we have some tape of their tete-a-tete. Is that right?
Yes, we do. I think it started. Perez Hilton was the judge who asked the question about gay marriage. And this is Carrie Prejean, Miss California, and this is her answer. Here it is.
In my country and in my family, I believe that a marriage should be between a man and a woman. No offense to anybody out there, but that's how I was raised, and that's how I think that it should be between a man and a woman. Thank you.
Wow. Thanks, Michelle.
Rob G here. Forget about how somebody is specifically on the issue, but, you know, kudos to her. I mean, if you think about, what was it, the Miss Teenage America, like a year or so ago, Miss South Carolina, who was, you know, they were asked her about what's some place in the world, and she starts going on this long babbling thing, and she can't put, you know, two words together. This young lady, you know, said, look, I let everybody have their own choices, but this is what I believe, and I think more power to her. But then to have, you know, the judge, Perez Hilton, you know, come out and bash her for it afterwards, I mean, I just thought that was just completely inappropriate.
Let me just tell you what he said.
He did trash her on his blog. We have tape of that. Here it is.
Well, if I was Miss California with half a brain, I would have said that is a question that each state should decide for themselves, because that's how our forefathers designed our government.
Thanks, Michelle. You know what? I mean, here's what I think. And this might get me a lot of trouble, but I'm thinking Perez Hilton, you know, he knew what was up when he asked his question, and right. we don't ask beauty contestants these heady questions of policy. You know, I mean, we haven't had Miss Cleveland or Miss Ohio asked about reparations or anything like that. You know,
Jimmy, you know what I'm saying?
I mean, this was very clearly self-serving.
He was pitching to himself.
He really wanted something to clock off. Go ahead, A-Train.
This is our salon, and I absolutely agree with you, and I give this week's redunculus to Perez Hilton because,
yes,
you know, at the end of the day, we live in a land of free speech, and whether or not you agree or disagree with the concept of same-sex marriage, to assume that a beauty pageant contestant is going to know the nuance of, you know, the Federalist, you know, doctrine of states' rights, and then doesn't agree with you to launch into ad hominem attacks. You know, he was supposed to be a judge, an impartial judge of this contest, and he did a redunculous job of it.
But isn't the whole thing lame that they have these interviews anyway? I mean, what are they trying to prove?
Well, especially it's Miss
USA. I mean,
USA.
I'm not trying to be mean,
I mean,
but
Miss America still has the talent. Miss USA, no. Just swimsuit, gown, and the interview.
Yeah.
I vote.
That's why you watch it, right?
Because Miss USA is owned by Donald Trump, so that's why
I was going to say, and for me, it reads more like, you know, Donald Trump, you know, this is his line he's shopping for in his next wife. And, you know, if it were my vote, if it were my country, because I'm that dude, I say we banish all pageants. And with that, I think it's a wrap.
I'm stunned into silence. Jimmy is putting the kibosh on beauty pageants. The world is spinning off its axis. I don't think I understand. Now, before we go, Jimmy, I understand you have something you wanted to say.
Okay, Michelle. Yes, I do. You know what? As many people know, we're coming up on the second anniversary of Tell Me More. Now, Michelle, I remember when The Barbershop was really just an experiment on the NPR blog back when you called the show Rough Cuts. Well, since the fellas in the shop have kept you company, made you laugh, and, well, sometimes made you want to scream at the radio, as Tell Me More and The Barbershop start a third year, we want to bring you, the listener, back into the mix. Now, send us your ideas. For instance, who else do you think is due for a shape-up in The Barbershop? Is there a guest you'd like to see or see on the radio, right? Or here join us in our weekly discussion? You know what? To tell us more about what you think, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. That's 202-842-3522. And remember to tell us your name. Or you can always go to our website at npr.org and blog it out.
Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com and TV1 Online. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Robert George is an editorial writer and columnist for The New York Post. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Brian Bennett is a contributor for Time magazine and a freelance writer. He joined us from our studios in Washington, along with Arsalan Iftikhar, the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and a civil rights attorney. And he was here, too. Gentlemen, thank you all so much.
Peace.
Hey, thank you. Yeah. See ya.
Yep.
And the program staff would also like to tell you what Tell Me More means to them. They've picked some of their favorite conversations from this past year and shared their thoughts. To read the stories they picked, see their photos, and get a backstage peek at what happens outside the studio, please visit our blog at the Tell Me More page at npr.org.